It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to a Cross Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, history fans. We're taking the day off, but don't worry. We've got plenty of classic shows to tide you over. Please enjoy these flashback episodes from the TDI-HC Vault. Hello and welcome to This Day in History Class, a show that replays the home runs of history one day at a time. I'm Gabe Lousier, and in this episode, we're talking about a breakthrough addition to the sporting goods catalog, a protective face mask that turned out to be a game changer for baseball catchers. The day was April 12, 1877. Harvard student James Ting became the first known baseball player to wear a catcher's mask. The new headgear was based on a design by Harvard team captain Frederick Thayer. It was made from a modified fencing mask and was meant to enable the catcher to get closer to the plate without fear of being injured by a ball or a bat. Despite that obvious benefit, Thayer's invention proved a tough sell, as most baseball players and fans considered it unmanly to wear protective gear. Baseball catchers had a rough time during the early years of their sport. Their position behind home plate put them directly in the line of fire during batting. Any foul ball or bad bounce was another potential bruise, a reality made more painful by the player's aversion to wearing protection. In those days, the only gear a catcher used was a rubber mouth guard, similar to that of a boxer. There was no mask, no chest guard, no shin guards, not even a glove. That reckless style of play led to frequent injuries, and as a result, the career of the average catcher was only 3 or 4 seasons. In the late 1860s, the rising popularity of the curveball made the catcher's job even more dangerous. Catchers were used to standing several feet behind the plate, but with a curveball, they had to come in much closer to make the catch, greatly increasing their odds of being struck. The change didn't go over well with some players, which is why the Harvard team of 1877 had such a hard time finding a catcher. The Crimson, as the team was called, actually started preseason training that year without a catcher. Team captain and third baseman Fred Thayer tried to fill the gap by moving in James Ting from the outfield, but Ting wasn't having it. He knew he was liable to get his nose broken or his teeth shattered playing catcher in the age of the curveball, and Thayer knew it too. The team captain came across a possible solution while walking across campus one day. He noticed that members of the fencing team were carrying face masks on their way to practice, and he wondered if something similar could work in baseball. Thayer got his hands on one of the masks and took it to a local tinsmith in Cambridge. They worked together on the design, making changes where needed to meet the needs of the sport. For example, the fine wire mesh of the fencing mask was too dense for baseball, as catchers needed to see everything on the field, not just directly in front of them. The solution was to replace the mesh with a series of intersecting metal bars that were wide enough apart to see through, yet narrow enough to stop a baseball. Thayer and the tinsmith also added a forehead pad and a chin rest to help absorb the impact of a ball. Thayer convinced Ting to try out the finished mask during practice, and when it proved effective, he agreed to be the team's new catcher. On April 12, 1877, Ting wore the mask during a game in Lynn, Massachusetts. It was a cold, windy day, but roughly 3,000 people turned out to watch the match. It wasn't a very good one, though, ending with a score of Harvard 11, Lynn 3. The main highlight was a strong showing from James Ting. He scored 2 runs, and more impressively, he made just 2 errors behind the plate, which was remarkably low for the era. The Harvard Crimson newspaper was completely won over by the catcher's mask, writing, quote, "The new mask proved a complete success, since it entirely protected face and head, and added greatly to the confidence of the catcher, who need not feel that he is every moment in danger of lifelong injury. To the ingenious inventor of this mask, we are largely indebted for the excellent playing of our new catcher, who promised to excel the fine playing of those who have previously held his position." But praise for the mask was not universal. The opposing team complained the mask had given Harvard an unfair advantage, and when the press learned of the new device, it was largely dismissed as cowardly. One alarmist critic leaned heavily on hyperbole, writing, quote, "We shall probably soon behold the spectacle of a player sculling around the bases with a stove funnel on his legs and boiler iron riveted across his stomach." Other reporters mocked the mask, calling it a rat trap, a muzzle, and a birdcage. One sports writer even went so far as to claim that baseball injuries didn't actually happen. Writing for the Portland Telegram, he said, quote, "There is a great deal of beastly humbug in contrivances to protect men from things which do not happen. There is about as much sense in putting a lightning rod on a catcher as there is a mask." Despite the public backlash, professional teams recognized the mask's advantages fairly quickly. Some players reached out to Thayer directly to request a mask of their own. The interest convinced Thayer to patent his invention the following year. By that time, the country's leading sporting goods manufacturer, A.G. Spaulding, had already begun selling Thayer's catching mask. In the years to come, the company made several improvements on the design, including additional padding and buckled straps. The only problem was Spaulding didn't have the rights to the mask. As a result, Thayer sued the company for patent infringement in 1883, and Spaulding was ultimately forced to pay him royalties. There was some initial hesitation to wear the new gear, as catchers were sometimes taunted by the crowds for hiding behind a mask. But in the end, keeping their faces intact proved more enticing than appeasing a few angry fans. By the late 1880s, the catcher's mask had been widely accepted by players and fans alike, and over time, other forms of protective gear were embraced as well, including shin guards, the chest protector, and the all-important catcher's mitt. As for Thayer's prototype mask, the one James Ting wore in that first game, no one's quite sure what happened to it. Today, there are 2 masks that are both purported to be the true original. One belongs to the Baseball Hall of Fame, and the other is on display in the reading room of the Harvard Varsity Club. It's unclear which mask is the genuine article, or maybe they're both wrong. In the end, which mask was first is less important than the fact that neither mask was last. Despite a rocky start, the catcher's mask has since become a fundamental piece of equipment, and baseball catchers are all the more handsome for it. I'm Gabe Lousier, and hopefully, you now know a little more about history today than you did yesterday. You can learn even more about history by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at TDIHCShow. And if you have any comments or suggestions, feel free to get in touch by writing to thisday@iheartmedia.com. Thanks to Chandler Mays and Ben Hackett for producing the show, and thank you for listening. I'll see you back here again tomorrow for another day in history class. Thank you. Hello, and welcome to This Day in History class, a show that demystifies history one day at a time. I'm Gabe Lousier, and today we're looking at the traumatic day when Americans learned that despite what the circus said, unicorns still didn't exist. The day was April 12th, 1985. The chief veterinarian of the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced that a famous circus animal alleged to be a unicorn was, in fact, a goat. Earlier that month, the Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus had revealed the supposedly mythical creature during a show at Madison Square Garden. The unicorn, known as Lancelot, was introduced with appropriate fanfare. He marched across a path of rose petals as the theme song from Rocky played in the background. The circus claimed that the unicorn had simply wandered into one of its tents after a show in Houston the previous summer. According to Lancelot's handler, Heather Harris, no one knew where the animal came from or, quote, whether it flew here or walked or took a train. Most audiences didn't mind that cryptic backstory. They were just thrilled to see a real live unicorn, even if it did look suspiciously like a goat with a shaggy mane and a weird horn. But not everyone was happy to see the so-called living unicorn. After the New York debut in early April, animal rights groups such as the Humane Society and the ASPCA voiced concerns about the animal's welfare. They were pretty sure that Lancelot wasn't a real unicorn, and they wondered what the circus might have done to make a normal goat look more like a storybook creature. Representatives from the ASPCA went to the circus to investigate. They expected to find a fake horn strapped to the goat's head, but once they got up close, they could tell the horn wasn't a prop. This was even more troubling to animal rights advocates. It suggested that a real horn had somehow been implanted or grafted to the center of the animal's head. Such a process would not only be painful, but could potentially affect the animal's long-term health as well. In light of that discovery, the president of the ASPCA implored the public to boycott the circus. He also demanded the chance to examine Lancelot, as well as the three other unicorns that served as stand-ins for the show's star. However, as you might expect, Ringling Brothers said no. A spokesman for the circus refused to comment on the origin of Lancelot's horn or his status as a possible goat. Instead, he stuck to the company script, saying, quote, "The animal arrived at our show in Houston in July 1984. We don't know how or why, but they were just there." As the cry for boycotts grew louder, Ringling Brothers fought back by taking out full-page newspaper ads urging fans to come see the living unicorn for themselves. The text warns, quote, "Don't let the Grinches steal the fantasy." It was at this point that the Department of Agriculture decided to step in. It dispatched a team of veterinarians led by Dr. Gerald Toms to determine whether the animals in question were some kind of goat or something else, as the circus claimed. After inspecting Lancelot and his stand-ins up close, Dr. Toms announced that they were indeed goats. He then added, quote, "But if you want to surrender to whimsy, then they're unicorns too." More importantly, the vet was able to confirm that the goats were in good health. Their horns were not implants or artificial additions, and the animals didn't seem bothered by them at all. The next day, Ringling Brothers held a press conference celebrating the all-clear from the USDA. They showed x-rays to prove that Lancelot's horn was a natural extension of his body, and even encouraged reporters to pull on it to show that it wouldn't come off. The circus felt vindicated, but it wasn't a complete victory. After all, Dr. Toms confirmed that the animals were officially goats, not unicorns. Some people thought that constituted a bait and switch. The circus had promised a living unicorn and instead delivered a one-horned goat. However, Ringling Brothers had an answer to that criticism as well. Spokeswoman Debbie Lind said, quote, "As far as we're concerned, it's a unicorn. A unicorn is an animal with one horn." And hey, she's not wrong. By now, though, you're probably wondering what the deal is with Lancelot's horn. How did he and his three stand-ins, Galahad, Avalon, and Percival, all wind up with one central horn instead of two lateral ones? The answer, as Dr. Gerald Toms deduced, was that the goats had undergone a surgical procedure at a very young age. When a goat is less than a week old, the buds of its horns are still a part of the skin and are not yet connected to the animal's skull. Because of this, someone was able to maneuver the unfixed horns into the middle of the goat's forehead and then stitch them close together. Over time, as the horns grew and intertwined, they gradually fused into a single horn. If anesthesia was used during that procedure, then it's unlikely the animals felt any pain or suffered from any lasting effects. But even if they felt no discomfort, there's something inherently distasteful about altering the biology of a developing animal purely for the sake of aesthetics or to make some money. To be clear, though, the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus didn't have anything to do with the actual surgeries, and for that matter, neither did any doctor. Instead, the horn manipulation was carried out by Oberon Zell, an artist, writer, and self-proclaimed wizard who had a passion for cryptozoology and neo-paganism. Zell became fixated on historical references to unicorns, the horse-like creatures whose single horn was said to have purifying effects on whatever it touched. Zell's studies eventually led him to the research of Franklin Dove, a biologist who had developed a method for fusing the horns of a goat back in the 1930s. Intrigued by the prospect of crafting his own unicorns, Zell, who had taken biology and pre-med in college, decided to give it a try. With a bit of effort and the help of his life partner Morning Glory, Zell pulled off the procedure. Pretty soon, he had 9 single-horned goats, or unicorns, and from 1980 to 1984, he made a living displaying the animals at Renaissance fairs. During these appearances, he was, of course, dressed like a wizard. Eventually, Zell was put in touch with Ringling Brothers, who were always looking for new acts to freshen up the show. The circus was impressed with Zell's unicorns and signed a 4-year licensing deal to take 4 of the animals on a national tour. It was reportedly worth about $500,000, but as part of the deal, Zell had to keep quiet about his role, including the methods by which the horns had been grown. Although the circus had signed a 4-year deal with Zell, it ultimately cut Lancelot from the show after just 2 years. The decision was largely meant to keep the show from getting stale, as rotating acts ensured that repeat visitors wouldn't see the same circus every time. But you have to imagine that all of that negative publicity was a factor as well. In either case, once public interest in unicorns had cooled, the circus moved on to promoting its next big act, and that was King Tusk, a 12-foot-tall elephant, whose tusks were thankfully in the right places. As for Lancelot and the backup goats, they returned back to Oberon Zell and Morning Glory in 1987. According to an interview Zell gave years later, the star animal was never the same after his time in the spotlight. Zell said, quote, "He was generally pretty depressed, because he loved being a show animal. I built a barn and corral just for him that we dubbed Fort Unicorn. We took care of him until his eventual death a few years later, in 1991, at the age of 11. Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus carried on itself until 2017, when declining interest and long-standing concerns about animal rights finally forced the show to close for good. In today's world, unicorns are firmly back in the realm of fantasy where they belong, meaning that fans of symmetrical goats can finally rest easy. I'm Gabe Lousier, and hopefully you now know a little more about unicorn history today than you did yesterday. If you want to learn even more about today's topic and see Lancelot for yourself, look us up on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at TDIHCShow. You can also rate and review the show wherever you get your podcasts, or you can write to us directly at thisday@iheartmedia.com. Thanks to Chandler Mays for producing the show, and thank you for listening. I'll see you back here again tomorrow for another day in history class.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to a Cross Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.